whether it's trains, planes, automobiles, motor coaches, safety has to be our number one concern.
The U.S. Transportation Secretary visits Alaska. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, September 27th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a court rules in favor of the state in a pebble mine case.
The public has to be ever vigilant with respect to this project because we don't think the state is doing its job.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Federal Aviation Administration sets standards for the operation of aircraft in airports and provides services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska, so when passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. There's more information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska or toll-free at 1-866-357-4704. This message sponsored by the FAA.
Federal Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood met with Alaska officials in Girdwood this morning to discuss the state's transportation challenges with a special focus on the safety of the highway corridor between Seward and Anchorage. So far this year, there have been 3 fatalities on the highway. Last year, there were 5. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports.
Secretary Ray LaHood and his entourage rode an Alaska Railroad excursion train from Anchorage to Girdwood. Outside the windows of the glass-domed car, fall colors blazed against a clear sky, while inside, railroad officials briefed the secretary about the history and the current state of the railroad, its challenges, and its passenger service so vital to the state's tourism industry. But skies clouded in Girdwood as an early morning meeting began. The topic turned to the safety issues associated with the Seward Highway, and many of the 12 seated at the table pressed the secretary with concerns about the high number of fatal automobile accidents that occur on the traffic corridor. Girdwood Fire Chief Bill Chadwick said emergency first responders have a tough job.
They're the ones that go out and clean up after the accidents, do the emergency medical work, and take the victims to the hospital. Our objective here is to do what we can to improve safety on the highway and to reduce the number of times that we have to go out there and clean up the mess and put people in body bags.
Seward Mayor Willard Dunham.
I've been driving the Seward Highway since it was opened in 1952. I've seen the good, the bad, and the ugly on all sides, and I'm delighted to be invited to this to talk about what we can do to help change it, improve it, and stop the carnage.
Both men said a 4-lane Seward Highway would be safer. LaHood told them he had served in Congress 4 years before taking the Secretary of Transportation job.
Safety is our number one priority, whether it's trains, planes, automobiles, motor coaches, any form of transportation that we have jurisdiction over, we take our safety agenda to be our number one agenda. Safety has to be our number one concern.
Mayor Dunham asked what Alaska can expect from a new transportation bill. LaHood responded that federal safety dollars have been used to improve the Seward Highway and that fatal accidents have been reduced, but he said that's not a long-term fix.
If the goal really is a 4-lane road, which is a much longer-term goal because of the process and the amount of money that you're talking about, then that's what you need to really persuade your delegation to make sure that it's a part of a surface transportation bill.
LaHood is in the state at the invitation of Senator Mark Begich. The secretary will meet with air carriers on aviation issues in Anchorage on Wednesday. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
A newly formed special legislative committee is taking the first steps toward finding long-term fiscal stability for the state. The House Fiscal Policy Committee is ready to hire a consultant specializing in communications who will work to strengthen the public's understanding of the state budget. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
The Special House Committee is the offshoot of a fiscal policy working group created by Kodiak's Alan Osterman, now House Majority Leader. It met for nearly 2 years, studying why previous attempts to reform the state's fiscal structure have failed. The group ended during this year's session with less than one page of recommendations, and Special Committee Chair Anna Fairclough, a Republican from Eagle River, says the members determined that a knowledgeable public is key to any solution. And that's where the communications consultant comes into the picture. Fairclough says people need to see Alaska's future without oil money in it.
I think we have a win if the general public understands that a gas pipeline, use of the permanent fund dividends, and a sales tax or an income tax will not meet what we're currently receiving in dollars from oil production. And so that's what scares me as an Alaskan is, it's wonderful that we've had this history, but if we don't take a significant look at where we're at today, how can we plan for where we're going to be tomorrow?
Fairclough says the answers can best be found outside the capital, where the communities have already determined their own priorities. She says that's the message that needs to be brought back to the legislature, not as a partisan solution. The consultant the committee will hire will devise a way to make financial presentations through the state and for giving the public a basic foundation in how government is paid for. From that, she says, the goal is to build a consensus among a very broad spectrum of politics and philosophy.
We can work together and we can figure out what the best next step is should Alaska see, you know, a downturn in income. But, you know, we can't throw stones at each other when people bring genuine ideas or concerns to the table.
The task force that set the direction of the committee was made up of people from the private and public sectors, and it did not have any partisan stand. Anchorage Democrat Mike Dugan was on it. He says it became apparent that the public must be a part of the discussion of the state's finances. He says the state now has somewhere between $12 and $15 billion it could spend, and everyone in the legislature has an idea on how to use some of it.
Before we do any of that, it seems to me that we should have some sort of an idea what we're trying to do overall. And before we do that, it seems to me that we have to invite the general public into some sort of discussion about that. Because if we don't, what's going to happen is, you know, the legislature will, you know, pick the ideas that have got the most votes, and that money will be gone.
The consultant who will devise a communications plan will be chosen within the month. The direct education process will begin after next year's session. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
A Superior Court judge in Alaska has issued a ruling in a lawsuit related to land and water permits given to the company looking at developing Pebble Mine. KDLG's Mike Mason has the story.
The plaintiffs in the just-decided lawsuit were represented by the public interest law firm Trustees for Alaska, which released a press release Tuesday confirming that the plaintiffs are considering appealing the case to the Alaska Supreme Court. Nancy Wainwright is a staff attorney for Trustees. She contends that DNR has not been adequately monitoring the activities at the Pebble site.
We now have more evidence from this year that there's violations going on, and so the public has to be ever vigilant with respect to this project because we don't think the state is doing its job.
Specifically, the lawsuit charged that the state of Alaska violated the Alaska Constitution by allowing Pebble exploration to go on for 2 decades with no analysis of impacts to resources and no public notice. The Department of Law's HESI says the court determined that the miscellaneous land use and temporary water use permits don't require the kind of public notice called for in the arguments made by Trustees for Alaska.
What the court is finding is, by virtue of the nature of these particular permits, which don't dispose of an interest in state land, public notice is not required.
In the trial and subsequent filings, the plaintiffs allege that exploration drilling at the Pebble study area has caused permanent environmental harm from the drilling of core holes, the discharging of drill cuttings, and the discharge of drill muds and fluids. The ruling handed down by Superior Court Judge Eric Arseth claims the evidence presented at trial was insufficient for the court to find that the exploration activities have actually caused or will in fact cause long-term harmful environmental impacts from acid rock drainage or other contamination. Nancy Wainwright with Trustees for Alaska contends that evidence at trial showed harm to the environment from the discharge of materials and from the withdrawal of water.
What we were asking for is for the state, before it issues a permit, to analyze whether there is a potential for harm and to determine if Pebble is going to drill 1,200 holes and dump millions of gallons of drilling woods and drilling waters onto the tundra and into sumps that are unlined. How will that affect the environment?
The plaintiffs have 30 days to file to appeal the Superior Court's decision to the Alaska Supreme Court. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, wasted deer meat prompts an investigation in Sitka.
Everyone who's a legal, ethical hunter sees that as a sort of a disgusting thing to do.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein. Attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Solstice Advertising, bringing creativity to Alaska businesses and nonprofits. From research and strategy to print, web, and broadcast production. Solstice Advertising, an agency for brands that want to shine.
Alaska wildlife troopers in Sitka are investigating one case of wanton waste and one case of failure to salvage all edible meat from several deer found near town recently. The first, last Wednesday, involved an animal found in the driveway entrance to the Sitka High School. Tim Hall is a wildlife trooper based in Sitka.
Deer was left on the sign overnight, completely unsalvaged and not gutted, not field dressed. There was no meat taken from it, apparently left as a prank.
Hall does not know whether the deer had been shot or hit by a car, only that it was completely intact and beyond salvage. Prank or no, the failure to salvage meat from a game animal is a serious crime. However, not all waste is necessarily wanton. Hall says sometimes animals are simply salvaged poorly. He says the most common motive is simply not taking the time to do it right.
Often it's people being in a hurry when they're butchering. It takes a few extra minutes to get all the meat off the deer and grind that into hamburger or whatever else people like to do with it, or give it to a charity if you don't want it. And, those few extra minutes apparently are fairly precious to some folks after a weekend of deer hunting.
That seems to be the case with three carcasses found on Sunday. Two small bucks and a doe had each been shot one time, but large amounts of meat remained on the carcasses. The incident is being investigated as a lesser crime than wanton waste, the failure to salvage all edible meat. He says most folks find these crimes difficult to forgive.
The big thing here is that people are outraged about deer being wasted. I think everyone who's a legal, ethical hunter sees that as a sort of a disgusting thing to do.
The unsalvaged deer carcasses were donated to the Fortress of the Bear. When Bethel voters head to the polls October 4th, they will be essentially electing an entire council. Six of the seven seats are up for grabs, the most ever. And voters could influence who fills the seventh and final seat, which will open just a few weeks later. Here to explain this municipal election in the western Alaska city is reporter Shane Iverson from member station KYUK in Bethel. Hi, Shane.
Good afternoon, Laurie.
So, Shane, this sounds like a record-setting election. How is it that so many seats are open at once?
Well, I guess you could say it started about 5 years ago or so when the city council became concerned about the number of candidates that were opening themselves up to the election process. Basically, candidate participation was low. So they moved from three-year terms to two-year terms, and as those three-year terms dried up, now these two-year terms make it so on any given year we have to elect three or four council candidates. This year would have been four. You throw in two resignations on top of that, one for health issues, another for some family and personal reasons, someone who had to leave town, and now we have six seats open.
You said there were problems getting enough candidates to run in the past. Were there any issues this time around getting enough to fill six seats for this election?
Actually, up until the last minute, there are only two candidates in the running. We did a story here at KYUK with about 24 hours before the election deadline was up to file for candidacy. And at that time, they hadn't even had people come in to get the election material. So it was looking kind of dire at that point. But I guess people became concerned. One of our former lawmakers, former Representative Mary Sattler, was known to call quite a few people, get on the horn, rally several candidates. She herself jumped in the running, and now we have 9 candidates plus a run-in.
So looking at your crop of candidates, what are the chances that this election could change the direction of some major issues for the city of Bethel?
That's a tough question, because there's not really a lot of one issue type of voters or one issue type of voting going on here. And because it is local politics, a lot of the issues people feel the same about. One major issue, though, that's come up and gets a lot of attention is a swimming pool. There's been a movement here in town to build a rec center here. As many people might know, Western Alaska has the highest rate of drowning in the state and possibly in the nation. And also, there's just not a lot of outlets for safe and fun activities for families and for youth. So the city has twice voted to raise taxes on ourselves with the idea that it would go towards this rec center swimming pool. But there's also a lot of concern that it could be a huge financial burden for the city to carry forward into the future. This last council has been very cautious and some might argue slow in moving towards the creation of a pool or a large rec center, which is billed at $24 million right now. But it looks like some of the candidates in the running now are positioning, you know, as people that want to see that project move forward a little bit more expeditiously. But it really depends on the election and who Bethel voters do decide on, because there are enough candidates that they do have some choices.
Well, thanks for helping us understand the process coming up to this election that you'll be having in Bethel.
Thanks, Lori, and I'll make sure to get back with the results.
All right, Shane Iverson from member station KYUK in Bethel. A giant drilling rig is completely blocking one of the main roads near Prudhoe Bay. BP was moving the rig, called Doyon 16, slowly between the Milne Point field and Prudhoe Bay on September 20th, when one of its enormous wheels broke through the road surface. Crews have been working to free the rig, but in the meantime, the normal flow of traffic on the road has come to a halt. BP spokesman Steve Reinhart says this is not a common occurrence.
I've heard of this happening at least once before. I don't know the details of that. It's not unheard of, but even in the ordinary course of events, moving a rig across the oil field is something that has to be done very carefully, is planned in advance, and happens very slowly.
Getting the rig unstuck also happens very slowly. Reinhart says crews will probably have it moving again by the end of the week.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the Bethel Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. BethelPartnership.com.
First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender. And by
AT&T, rethink possible. Details at att.com/Alaska or 1-800-252-7266.
The National Indian Health Board Convention is underway in Anchorage, and many of the workshops will focus on funding issues. KMBA's Jacqueline Estes has more.
The National Indian Health Board meets this week at the Dena'ina Center in Anchorage. NIHB Executive Director Stacy Bolin of the Sault Ste. Marie Tribe of Chippewa Indians says NIHB works on behalf of the nation's 569 tribes to improve the health status and delivery of health care to Native Americans. In reaction to a popular misconception about federally funded health care for Native Americans, she says it's not free.
American Indians and Alaska Natives, without exception, have paid for their health care with their land, their culture, their language, their very lives. in many, many cases.
Tribes criticize the government for spending more on health care for federal prisoners than Native Americans. Boland says the biggest issue in health services for Native Americans is lack of resources.
Frankly, when health care is not appropriately provided for now, and the treaty obligations and the agreements that were made with our people are not honored today, we're still paying with our lives.
Workshops on money run throughout the convention this week, with sessions on the Indian Health Service budget, reimbursement from private insurance companies, a full day on Medicare and Medicaid. Other topics include obesity, diabetes, HIV, and fetal alcohol syndrome. Patrick Anderson is executive director of Chugachmut, which provides health and social services and education to seven Prince William Sound and Lower Cook Inlet villages. He's scheduled to speak on ways to prevent suicide. He says the first step is for people to understand that many negative behaviors, such as alcoholism, gambling, obesity, and domestic violence, are the result of what's called adverse childhood experiences.
They include having an absent biological parent, having a parent who is in prison, having a depressed family member, having an alcoholic family member, being physically abused, physically neglected, emotionally abused, emotionally neglected, witnessing domestic violence in the household, or having been the victim of contact sexual abuse.
Anderson says remedies may include everything from a healthier diet to alternative therapies such as meditation. The National Indian Health Board Convention continues through Thursday. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Jocelyn Estes.
The Alaska Mental Health Trust is changing its approach to a major land exchange with the federal government. A legislative proposal to swap 20,000 acres of its property in southeast towns for federal lands it could log or develop has made little headway in Congress. So the agency plans to propose an administrative exchange, which could be approved by the Forest Service instead. KFSK's Matt Lichtenstein reports.
The idea of a land exchange was originally prompted by public objections over a late 2005 plan to log Mental Health Trust property on the steep hillsides along Mitkoff Highway in Petersburg. Highway residents have long argued that logging there would further destabilize already landslide-prone slopes above their homes and businesses. Keeping that from happening has been a frustrating six-year struggle for Ed Wood and fellow members of the Mitkoff Highway Homeowners Association. Wood and other homeowners' safety concerns were punctuated by this year's late September landslide that dumped a 12-foot-high pile of rocks, mud, and tree trunks across both lanes of the highway. It's one of several slides that have occurred in the area, and Wood said it could have been worse.
Along with today's slide at 6.2 mile, I heard dozens of trees blowing down all across the upper slopes, especially on the Twin Creek shoulder. I think if the TLO had helicopter logged as it had originally planned to do in 2006, there wouldn't be anything left standing today, and we'd have even more slides. It's pretty obvious that it's in our community's best interest that the slopes on this hillside be left alone. I think it's time that the TLO traded these parcels to the Forest Service, if it'll still take them, and moves on.
It's been about 4 years since trust officials said they'd consider a land exchange as an alternative to logging or selling trust property on Mitkoff Highway and other sensitive areas and communities around Southeast. The idea was to resolve conflicts with adjacent property owners while also meeting the trust's mission to generate income for mental health services in Alaska. In early 2010, the trust proposed a legislative land exchange, one that would have to be approved by Congress. It involved trading 20,000 acres of Southeast trust lands for roughly 50,000 acres of Forest Service property that the trust would be able to manage for logging. That proposal's not gotten very far. Now, trust resource manager Paul Slenkamp says the agency is revising its plan to try for an administrative exchange as well, one that it will negotiate with Forest Service officials.
This is going to be a very negotiated type agreement, and we're pretty cautiously optimistic of moving forward with this. We're still looking at the legislative method, and we're actually open to resolving this situation. I mean, not only in Petersburg, but throughout Southeastern. I mean, the trust is major landowner in almost every community of Southeastern.
Suncamp says the trust is hoping to move forward and meet with the Forest Service again within the next month. Tonga Supervisor Forrest Cole says the two agencies have had several informal discussions about an administrative exchange. The trust laid out specific parcels to trade, including most of the Mitkoff Highway property, in its earlier legislative proposal. But according to Cole, the Forest Service did not consider that an equal value exchange. Cole says an administrative exchange would have to be equal value.
What the issue was last time was, because it was not a equal value land exchange, it got wrapped in with landless natives' interests and Sea Alaska's interests and a host of others, and at that point in time there wasn't much traction in terms of new legislation. So going through the equal value exchange administratively, the process would be the rangers go through, pick out what they feel is in the public interest. We would go through an appraisal process and basically start running it up to the regional forester, then the Washington office.
Whatever the proposal, the administrative process would still require a lengthy environmental and public review under the National Environmental Policy Act. In Petersburg, I'm Matt Lichtenstein.
The Naval Research Laboratory's new military communications satellite, TACSAT-4, lifted off without a hitch at sunrise today from the Kodiak Launch Complex. The Narrow Cape rocket site is about 25 miles from Kodiak City.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. We have liftoff of the Minotaur-4 launch vehicle carrying the Navy's TACSAT-4 communications satellite to orbit from Alaska Aerospace Corporation's Kodiak launch site for DOD's Operationally Responsive Space Office. This marks the Naval Research Lab's 100th satellite launch and Orbital Sciences' 23rd Minotaur launch, lofting a total of 41 satellites and payloads into space.
Within a few minutes, all that could be seen from the ground was a column of smoke illuminated by the rising sun. The TACSAT-4 is an experimental spacecraft that will test advances in satellite communications and the use of special orbits to augment current communication satellites. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Mike Mason in Dillingham, Ellen Lockyer and Jacqueline Estes in Anchorage, Ed Ronco in Sitka, Shane Iverson in Bethel, Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg, and Jay Barrett in Kodiak. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Business Monthly Magazine, providing insight on statewide business and government issues. There's more information online at akbizmag.com.
And by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health, and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.